With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. The World Dairy Expo will host a dairy symposium featuring the Dairy Business Innovation, also known as DBI, initiatives from across the country coming up on Tuesday, October 3rd. It's being held from 8 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. And the DBI supports dairy businesses and the development, production, marketing, and the distribution of dairy products. Registration is now open and can be found by visiting datcp.wi.gov. And now let's get into today's show headlines. Agriculture groups send a letter to presidential candidates on boosting trade. Major U.S. agricultural organizations sent letters to all 2024 presidential candidates asking them to prioritize trade. The letters encourage each candidate to prioritize new market access trade agreements to help strengthen U.S. ag and decrease a reliance on China. Brian Keel, executive director of Farmers for Free Trade, says the U.S. has stood on the sidelines in world trade long enough.
We're certainly still trading, but you know, the U.S. is going to run a food and ag trade deficit this year of nearly $18 billion, a historic high in terms of how much more we're importing than exporting. And some of that is year-round produce that's coming in and it's high cost. I get that. But part of it is it's been 10 years since the U.S. entered into a new free trade agreement. So we've updated NAFTA and we've updated South Korea, but it's been 10 years since we broke into a new country.
NAFB contributed to that report, and now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
2023 continues to be a wild year for weather, with a tropical storm hitting California over the weekend. While areas of Southern California have seen significant impacts from heavy wind and rain, Fresno County Farm Bureau CEO Ryan Jacobson said that farmers in the area were fortunate compared to what some of the early expectations were calling for from the storm.
They say no 2 years are alike when it comes to farming, and definitely 2023 has been a very interesting year on the weather side. The fact that we've had now, in the first time in over 80-plus years, we've had a tropical storm make landfall in August here in California has definitely been one for the memory. And fortunately, right now, it's looking like the impacts are not as significant as initially projected. We did see rainfall here in the San Joaquin Valley, but not to the upper ends of what was the potential projections out there. Here in the Fresno region, we're anywhere between, a tenth of an inch to a quarter of an inch, depending on where you're at. There are some foothill communities that received more than that, maybe towards the half inch or above. But overall, those projections were expected to be anywhere from a half inch to an inch. Down in Kern County, they were expected to actually be 1.5 to 2.5 inches. And so we didn't see those. No immediate impacts, but there could be some longer term impacts depending on what crops you look at.
Weather patterns have made for a challenging watermelon season. VP of Crops and Soils at Van Groningen & Sons Incorporated, Brian Van Groningen, said the spring rain and summer heat spikes have created a variety of issues for their watermelons.
At one time, we had almost 1 million transplants sitting in greenhouses in the last couple weeks of March that were ready to be planted, and we had no place to plant them because the fields were too wet. Luckily, we got those in the ground, and I think some of our production might be a result of that because some of the plants were a little bit older. We lost some of the transplants that didn't survive, and the fields were just not, I guess, in top condition to be planted, a little on the wet side and things like that. So we've had minor quality issues this year that we normally don't see. We had a lot of those temperature spikes and such, and so we're seeing a little bit of small fruit quality issues that we otherwise wouldn't see. Nothing major, maybe 5%. A seedless will develop black mature seeds because it's under stress, or sometimes we'll get hollow heart, which is just a result of the plant trying to grow too fast at certain periods of time and then not fast enough at other times, just real wild temperature swings. So we've had some minor quality issues, but at this point, it seems like everything's kind of went away and we're kind of in real good quality.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, Florida Republican Congresswoman Kat Kamick spoke at the Sweetener Symposium held in California last week and said she's expecting a battle over the farm bill. In an interview with us this week, she explained some of the issues she sees. First, the money.
Certainly the price tag. That's, I think, first and foremost, the cause for concern for my colleagues on the right. For my colleagues on the left, the price tag is not enough.
And that's not the only issue. She said every farm bill has a battle over the nutrition title, which is about 80% of the bill and goes to programs such as SNAP and WIC. But that's not all.
You know, the farm bill price tag has always been a point of contention every single time it's come up. You have a very lopsided farm bill in every time it comes up because 80%, in this case 82% of the farm bill is going to nutritional, whereas 6% and then the remainder goes to food production. You have a very, very small number of people putting food on the shelf and a very large number of people taking food off the shelf. So you have to ask yourself, how much longer can we go down this path? How far can this trend line go before it is no longer sustainable? So that's always a point of contention. You know, a lack of effort to get rid of the waste, fraud, and abuse in the nutritional programs is always a point of contention. So I think you're going to have niche groups fighting over niche issues, which ultimately makes the path to a very successful and productive farm bill very difficult.
She said another factor that complicates the farm bill is the regionality of it. Each of the nation's growing regions has different crops and different needs.
Well, I mean, you think, for example, in the Southeast, particularly here in Florida, the issue of seasonal and perishable provisions and protections are top of mind, as well as AGI, right? Those are two of the big, big issues that our producers think about day in, day out. Where if you look at the Midwest guys, for example, your corn and your soybean producers, the trade deals like USMCA and NAFTA did great things for them, but it severely hurt us in the Southeast. So you have to reconcile how some of these outside factors and policies impact different regions. So, you know, certainly we're not a corn or, you know, soybean state. We produce sweet corn in Florida, but, you know, you think about those issues have been completely ignored by the national policy for the longest time. And so that's where those regional interests and competing interests come in because, you know, no one wants to undercut someone else's program to benefit their own, but there has to be a balance. There has to be some form of equal representation and assistance throughout the farm bill for every different region. Because if you look, like I said, the Midwest is a great example for how they differ in different parts. But, you know, look at the Southeast compared to the Northwest. Completely different. You know, we're not producing apples. They are. And they have a totally different subset of issues than we do.
Still, she says it's an important piece of legislation, a fact that will help get it passed.
The thing that the chairman, as well as members of the committee, have continued to push for within their own spheres of influence was this is a national security bill. This isn't just a farm bill. This is a national security bill because we need to start talking about agriculture as a national security concern. So if people can see it through that lens, I think then they can maybe start to come around on some of the finer points.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, Brazil's Minister of Agriculture and Livestock recently announced that the Dominican Republic has granted access for imports of Brazilian pork and beef. U.S. Meat Export Federation's John Harith has a story looking at what this actually means for U.S. red meat exports.
The Dominican Republic recently announced it will grant access for Brazilian beef and pork. As U.S. Meat Export Federation Vice President of Economic Analysis Aaron Bohr explains, it's an important market for U.S. exports.
It's one of those markets where we have dominant market share, in part because of our free trade agreement through the CAFTA DR. And it's also been a really strong growth market for U.S. beef and pork. And so if we just look at so far this year, the U.S. pork exports to the Dominican Republic are about $145 million. It's our sixth largest market. And our exports are up 26% in the first half compared to a record pace of last year. And U.S. pork also accounts for the majority of Dominican pork consumption. For U.S. beef, it's our ninth largest market in the first half of this year when we look at a value basis, and our exports are up 9%. So pretty impressive in what's otherwise been kind of a challenging year coming off the highs of last year.
Because of the Central America Free Trade Agreement, the U.S. will have a significant tariff advantage in the market.
It is important to note that U.S. pork enters at zero tariff, and Brazil will pay the 25%, which is the Dominican's base rate or non-FTA rate on pork imports. The DR has a 40% tariff on non-FTA beef coming into the country. So from my sort of outside read, that looks like a pretty steep barrier to Brazilian beef. Obviously, their price point will be much lower than U.S., but it's a different product as well.
So far, three Brazilian plants have been approved to ship to the DR, with two more reportedly under consideration. For more, please visit usmef.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harith.
Thanks, John. And registration and housing are now open for the 2024 Cattle Industry Convention and NCBA Trade Show. It'll be held in Orlando, Florida. CattleCon 24, as it's called, the cattle industry's largest event of the year, is where cattle producers from across the country will gather January 31st through February 2nd, 2024, for business meetings, educational sessions, engaging speakers, and family fun. Attendees can look forward to a variety of educational opportunities. That includes the Cattle Facts Outlook Seminar, weather and industry updates, grazing management workshops, guest speakers on the trade show floor, and the 31st Annual Cattlemen's College. Leaders in sustainability, quality, and cattle feeding will get recognized also during a stewardship program reception. Cattlemen's College is being reimagined this year with classroom sessions and hands-on demonstrations, and there's a variety of ticket packages available. To learn more, go to ncba.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do you listen?
I just want to stay informed while I'm on the go.
News on the radio, it's nice because it's just a quick snippet and I don't have to go searching for it or grab a paper.
I listen to radio because anywhere that I'm going, I'm listening to music or I'm listening to a talk show or I'm just trying to stay up on current events.
I always turn into the radio to see if I need to take shelter, where it's hitting, to see what I need to be preparing for.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A proposed rule to strengthen horse protection. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service seeks public input on a proposed rule to strengthen Horse Protection Act requirements. Announced last week, the proposed changes aim to eliminate horse soaring, which is a practice that gives horse owners and trainers an unfair advantage in walking horse competitions. Walking horses are known for possessing a naturally high gait, but to be more successful in competitions, some owners and trainers use improper training methods to exaggerate a horse's gait. The methods may cause the horse to suffer from physical pain, distress, inflammation, or lameness while walking and moving. USDA's Jenny Lester Moffitt says by strengthening the HPA regulations, we can all work to eliminate soaring, which will improve the welfare of horses competing in the shows and level the competitive playing field. You can submit comments by searching for the proposal at regulations.gov. APHIS will consider all comments received on or before October 20th. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. Most states have some form of sales tax exemption for ag-related purchases by farmers. The exemption generally involves equipment, inputs, and replacement parts, but each state's exemption is different. Unfortunately, the statutes tend to be confusing, and the implementing regulations are often limiting. Are the purchases of items that you use on the farm exempt from sales tax? Generally, purchases of new and used farm equipment are exempt, but it will depend on the particular state exemption statute. Often the item purchased must be used directly in the production of agricultural commodities or livestock. This means that the purchase of an ATV, UTV, or excavator are not exempt because crop scouting, fixing fence, mowing, or making improvements to waterways don't directly involve production activities. Also, consumable supplies are probably not exempt either. They aren't repair or replacement parts. Make sure you complete an ag exemption certificate. In most states, you'll have to provide the certificate at the time of purchase to certify your intended use of the product and your status as an exempt farmer. The implement or input dealer will likely request it, and you'll need the documentation to avoid potential trouble for yourself or the vendor. Sales tax is complicated, and state exemptions vary in nature and type. Make sure to stay up to date on what your state law requires and provide the necessary documentation to your suppliers. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
A frequent USDA report is now changed in name to reflect ongoing changes in technology.
The technology use survey was previously called the Farm Computer Use and Ownership Survey. And since the technology has evolved, right now we're collecting much more data rather than just computer usage on the farm and ownership. We're collecting all sorts of data about precision ag, about how farmers connect to the internet, and about how farmers use the internet for conducting business with USDA and outside of USDA.
Tony Dorn of the National Agricultural Statistics Service says this every other year survey builds upon data acquired since 1997. Among the findings of the 2023 Farm Technology Use Survey,
85% of farms reported having access to the internet. And that compares with 82% in 2021 of the farms that reported having access to the internet.
With the New England region leading the nation with 98% of farms connected to the internet.
Like in previous times, New Mexico and Arizona had the least percentage of farms with the internet. New Mexico had the smallest percentage, but 55%.
As for how ag producers connect to the internet,
smartphone usage has gone up. In 2023, we see that 82% of farmers only use a smartphone to connect to the internet on the farm. And this was an increase from 77% in 2021.
Looking at other devices used for internet connection,
most people connect to the internet using a laptop or desktop. And farmers reported doing that for 69%, the access through the internet using a laptop or desktop in 2023, and that compares with 67% in 2021.
As far as type of internet service used to connect to the World Wide Web,
51% of the farms have broadband access and access the internet through broadband, either DSL, cable, fiber optics, or something else. And as far as dial-up, 2% of the farmers reported accessing internet that way. As far as cellular, that came in at 75%. And satellite came in at 23% and 2% for others.
Dorn says for the second consecutive survey, data was collected on precision agriculture, which relies greatly on internet access.
27% of farms reported using precision ag practices in 2023, and that compares to 25% in 2021. As far as leading states, North Dakota was the leading state with 57% and Nebraska was second.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
The Pro Farmer Crop Tour enters critical areas in Illinois and Iowa, and the Federal Reserve Board summer retreat continues in Wyoming. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report at midweek, brought to you by Helena. Iowa is the only state that the Pro Farmer Tour hits every county.
Iowa is one state, scouts say, where a farmer could have one of the best yields ever, and 10 miles away, a farmer could have one of the worst years. Western Illinois provides a similar scenario and will be covered before East meets West in Rochester, Minnesota, tomorrow night. We see corn futures oversold below that 480 level, and November soybeans making another run, though, at the $14 level. Kansas City wheat gave ground, we think, too easily earlier this week. September, near $7, is a buying opportunity in our view. This is the Bottom Line Report. Fed Chairman Powell speaks Friday morning in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, as part of the annual summer retreat. Two major questions remain: how high is high as far as interest rates to control inflation, and how long will they stay at those levels? I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
There's just over a month until the current farm bill expires, and some lawmakers are gearing up for a tough fight. Florida Republican Congresswoman Kat Kamick spoke at the Sweetener Symposium held in California last week and said she's expecting a battle over the farm bill. In an interview with us this week, she explained some of the issues she sees. First, the money.
Certainly the price tag.
And that's not the only issue. She said every farm bill has a battle over the nutrition title, which is about 80% of the bill and goes to programs such as SNAP and WIC. But that's not all.
I think you're going to have niche groups fighting over niche issues, which ultimately makes the path to a very successful and productive farm bill very difficult.
She said another factor that complicates the farm bill is the regionality of it. Each of the nation's growing regions has different crops and different needs. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Dr. Jennifer Roberts, a professional services veterinarian with Boehringer Ingelheim, talks about the importance of keeping cows healthy during the dry period and into freshening.
The dry period is a period of time where cows can be especially susceptible to mastitis infections. And when cows experience cases of mastitis, this can create a pretty significant impact for the producer because of economic losses resulting from cost of treating that cow, lower milk production in the next lactation. We also have added labor associated with treating those cows. And then we can see increased somatic cell count, as well as increased risk of culling from the herd because of those cases of mastitis. One of the things that happens during the dry period is that we're no longer monitoring that cow on a daily basis. We're not cleaning that cow's udder, and so we don't have as many opportunities to observe her. It puts her at higher risk. If we are not maintaining a good, clean, dry environment, it really increases their risk for environmental mastitis.
She talks about preparing cows for dry off.
Making sure that those cows are in a clean, dry, and comfortable environment. Cows are going to spend the majority of their day lying down, and their teeth are in direct contact with the material where they're laying down. Dirty bedding and a dirty environment can be a significant source of mastitis infections. The next thing is considering administration of an antibiotic at dry off, which can be used to treat either current subclinical infections that the cows may have at dry off, as well as helping to prevent new infections that may occur during the dry period. And then finally, applying an internal teat sealant to those cows to prepare them for the dry period is going to help reduce mastitis risk.
Roberts talks about important details producers should know about preventing mastitis.
One of the things that's key for that cow maintaining a healthy immune system is making sure that she's on a well-balanced plane of nutrition. And so working with a nutritionist to make sure that the ration is balanced and has all of those essential nutrients. Next, it's a good time at dry off to make sure that cows are up to date on all of their vaccinations. And if the herd struggles with a coliform mastitis issue, either during the dry period or after calving, it's a good idea to include a coliform mastitis vaccine as a means of prevention. Working with a veterinarian to develop a vaccination protocol that may incorporate those coliform mastitis vaccines and help with each farm's specific needs and goals is going to be a really important piece of preventing mastitis.
Again, that's Dr. Jennifer Roberts of Boehringer Ingelheim. Chad Smith reporting.
A return of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum to the U.S., with this year's event held recently in Seattle. Among the sessions with the itinerary of the three-day event, a meeting of the APEC food security ministers. Chairing that session, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack.
The APEC community shares a commitment to addressing global food needs now so that we can in fact build the resilient systems that can absorb future shocks like pandemics, conflict, severe weather, and a changing climate.
He elaborated that when it comes to both food and nutrition security across the globe, he believes that requires that
food be simultaneously available, accessible, and stable, as well as affordable. Constrictions within any of these components can result in food and nutrition insecurity.
This is not the first time the Secretary has participated in APEC or the Public Partnership on Food Security. As APEC Secretariat Executive Director Rebecca Fatima Santamaria explained,
the APEC ministers responsible for food security met for the first time in Niigata, Japan in 2010. But the Policy Partnership for Food Security was the brainchild of Secretary Vilsack when U.S. last hosted APEC in 2011.
She acknowledged the APEC roadmap for food security with goals hopefully to be reached by the year 2030. Meanwhile, U.S. Senior Official for APEC, Matt Murray, noted three priorities for the food security ministers at the PPFS for this year.
Building a resilient and interconnected region that advances broad-based economic prosperity. Enabling an innovative environment for a sustainable future. Affirming an equitable and inclusive future for all.
The Secretary and ministerial colleagues discussed climate solutions through agriculture, including the U.S.-based Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities. To that end, our nation and USDA announced two new initiatives at the APEC Forum. One is a food security dashboard that provides global decision makers data in areas such as trade disruptions and food insecurity. Also, interim field guides will be published covering subjects such as sustainable agricultural practices and public-private partnerships to address food security issues. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the show. For today's interview segment, I'm tossing it right on over to AgNet West, Brian German.
We're joined by Ryan Jacobson this morning, CEO of the Fresno County Farm Bureau, to get an update on crop conditions here in the latter part of August. And just to start off here, California got some pretty wild weather here over the weekend. And so, Ryan, we wanted to just check to see how that impacted farming operations there in your area.
Yeah, so very fascinating. You know, they say no 2 years are alike when it comes to farming, and definitely 2023 has been a very interesting year on the weather side. The fact that we've had now, in the first time in over, you know, 80 plus years, we've had a tropical storm make landfall in August here in California has definitely been one for the memory. And fortunately, right now, it's looking like the impacts are not as significant as initially projected. We did see rainfall here in the San Joaquin Valley, but not to the upper ends of what was the potential projections out there. Here in the Fresno region, you know, we're anywhere between, you know, a tenth of an inch to a quarter of an inch, depending on where you're at. There are some foothill communities that receive more than that, maybe towards the half inch or above. But overall, those projections were expected to be anywhere from a half inch to an inch. Down in Kern County, they were expected to actually be 1.5 to 2.5 inches. And so we didn't see those. No immediate impacts, but there could be some longer term impacts depending on what crops you look at.
So definitely you got some rain, but not to the level that earlier reports had been calling for there. And now in terms of crop impacts, which crops maybe have the most potential for problems with the rainfall here in late August?
So there's this interesting, you know, what we saw happen here with this major storm coming through hit us at, you know, what arguably would be one of the worst times to have that kind of storm come in the valley, because we have so many of our commodities that are at that very perishable stage right now, where rain is not a good thing. Obviously, a lot of the crops we grow here in the San Joaquin Valley need that long, dry growing season. We can take smaller storms, but the projection of this bigger storm was going to be on the problematic side, especially for things such as, you know, those perishable fresh fruits. So things such as, you know, grapes, table wine and raisin, those bunches this time of year, when they get high amounts of water in there, there's a very high susceptibility to rotting. And when that fruit is on the ripening side and it's and it gets that water in there, and that's very problematic when it comes to trying to harvest that, and you have that those problems. On top of that, peaches, plums, nectarines, anything that's on the real fresh side where it's close to ripening or ripened, is the crops that I think of first and foremost being highly susceptible to this kind of storm.
And while the rainfall didn't quite come in at the level of some of the early projections, there was quite a bit of wind that came through the valley. Is there any indication as to how that might have some impacts on production?
I am definitely watching or listening to hear what farmers find out in their fields when it came to that wind. There was some areas of the valley that experienced some very, very high winds. And so for some of those fresh fruits, there is the susceptibility to either bruising as they sit there and knock against the branches, or all together falling off. So there is the real possibility we do see some of those accounts coming in here within a relatively short time, because it just depends where you were at. There were some areas that were, you know, had some minor winds, but were very unscathed. There were some others that, you know, the potential for some damage there is to be expected, simply because they did experience it for such, not only for you know, the high winds, but it was the long durations. I mean, there was a few places where it went on for a few hours.
So between the rain and wind, some potential there for issues in some crops. And now just looking beyond the recent storm system, what does Fresno County look like in terms of crop conditions? I mean, how are things coming along otherwise?
No surprises here. The fact that we are extremely late when it comes to harvest this year because of that cool, wet spring, it really delayed the maturity of so many of our crops. And not only that, it was a cool, wet spring, and then we went into a very long duration where we had some very high temperatures. When you start getting to those, you know, anywhere in those 103s, 104, 105, the trees and vines really do, I don't want to say shut down, but they slow down as far as their production and their ripening of the fruit there. So we are behind. We're anywhere, I say, 2 to 3 weeks from average. You compare it to a drought year, I would argue it's anywhere from 3 to 5 weeks off of those early drought years, because, you know, what is average in a time in which, you know, 7 out of the last 10 years have been drought. We've seen that average date kind of pushed up, but now we're back to a behind average type of year. But we are fortunate because of that being behind. We didn't see as much of our perishable commodities on the ground, such as raisins and almonds, as in a normal year. And so they were probably able to, you know, sustain the rains better, simply because they were on the vine or tree versus being on the ground compared to a normal year. But what this does on these late years is it pushes. I'm not necessarily worried about the front end as much as I'm worried about the back end. The back end being that it's now pushing some of these harvest into mid to late October, all the way into November, in a year in which, you know, we're seeing a strong El Nino formation. Doesn't guarantee we're going to see rains, but a higher propensity that we may see some of those early rains. We're watching very carefully what happens as we move into that later summer, early part of fall there, where, you know, we're going to have a very condensed, busy harvest season as folks try to get all this stuff off it within a short timetable, because everything's going to be more condensed than usual.
So it has been a pretty unusual year all around as it relates to weather. And so with that kind of late start and it pushing production, it might have been a little favorable now with that recent rain system that came through. But looking at the next several weeks, there's going to be a lot of attention paid to weather to hopefully not run into any early season rains, trying to get through what sounds like could be a pretty hectic harvest season with so much going on in that condensed timeline, like you said.
Without a doubt. I think we're seeing that already right now. You know, harvest for almonds really got started here in the Fresno area last week. There was exceptions. Some people started earlier than that. But, you know, traditionally, I'm looking third, fourth week of July, we start to see the early ones going. And by first week of August, things are really humming. I would say now we're getting to the point this week where things are really going to get humming. There were a few folks, for example, that slowed down harvest towards later part of last week, they slowed down the shaking just so the nuts weren't on the ground when the storms came through. They're really going to get going this week, and things are going to be full speed ahead with just about every one of our commodities here in the valley, as you know, all of our fruits and nuts and so many of our crops come within this 6 to 8 week period that we're harvesting so many of them there. So it is go time for them to really try to pull those off in a little shorter period than we're typically used to.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Irrigation in arid California is as complicated as it is essential. Unpredictable supplies, uneven distribution, complicated application schedules, and regulation make it a challenge. No wonder help with water is the biggest request at USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Since 2014, NRCS has invested over $100 million helping over 1,000 California farmers conserve water. By using superior technology and savvy management, farmers get more crops with fewer drops. Join the Water Savings Club. Contact your local NRCS office. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Farmland partners say strong market is still adding value. Farmland values across the country climbed this year and hit record levels despite challenges like rising interest rates and extreme weather. That's according to data from the federal government. The Department of Agriculture found that U.S. farm real estate values, which includes all land and buildings on farms, increased 7.4% over the past year. Cropland values have grown 8.1% since 2022. Nationwide, value of farm real estate and cropland also increased sharply from 2021 to 2022, 12.4% and 14.3% respectively. Additional reports from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago and the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City confirm that USDA data. Farmland Partners Incorporated President and CEO Luca Fabri says, quote, "These studies and the similar reports coming from farm country show that the farmland market is still strong and adding value." Farmland Partners is an internally managed real estate that owns and or manages nearly 186,000 acres in 20 states. The National Association of Farm Broadcasters contributed to that report.
The National Future Farmers of America organization has reached a record high number of members this year. Student membership has reached nearly 946,000, marking an 11% increase over last year. The number of FFA chapters also continues to grow, increasing by 168. There's now 9,163 chapters in the U.S., Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. National FFA CEO Scott Stump said that it's exciting to see such growth in membership as the next generation of leaders continue making a difference in their communities and agriculture. The top five membership states of the organization are Texas, California, Georgia, Illinois, and North Carolina. The California Association currently serves over 95,000 student members in 338 schools, from urban schools in Los Angeles and the Bay Area to rural schools all across the state. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
CDFA releases data from its below-ground biodiversity report. A committee of soil scientists recently conducted a report on the below-ground biodiversity of California soil. The report provides targeted recommendations for policymakers and stakeholders to enhance soil health and conserve biodiversity. All of that play an important role in climate resiliency and food production. Dr. Scow, one of the report scientists, says, quote, "The state of California contains more than 2,500 types of soil. They host a wealth of life that makes vital contributions to the global food supply. Improved understanding of below-ground biodiversity is essential to achieving a carbon-neutral future and tackling climate change." Back in 2020, Governor Newsom issued an executive order emphasizing the significance of soils and called on the California Department of Food and Agriculture to enhance soil health and biodiversity by forming an advisory committee. CDFA Secretary Karen Ross says, quote, "We are thrilled to receive this body of work from the Below Ground Biodiversity Advisory Committee. This report makes it clear that biodiversity is essential for soil health, climate resiliency, food production, and nutrition security. I'm so grateful for the work of the committee and the Science Advisory Panel for making the report a reality." The report may be viewed by visiting cdfa.ca.gov and searching Soil Biodiversity in California Agriculture.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.